Give us that intro. A little of excitement. A little pep. Let's go. Be exciting.
Oh, I honestly didn't know you were recording.
Go!
Here we go! Welcome to Defined. Here we are. Rick and Eric, at it again.
And today, we have... I'm actually nervous about who we have today. I got to be honest.
Yeah, I could tell. I know. I think is going to be a fun talking point, to be fair.
We have Russ McCarroll today, who was pretty high up at A&E Networks. So he's interesting. I've worked with him for a while, and he's a good dude. I have to say that now that I've said I'm nervous, because if I said he was an asshole, that wouldn't be good.
Let's just explore that just a minute before he gets on here. You are nervous because why do you think?
Well, for a couple of reasons. Well, I honestly didn't think we were going to go into a therapy session, but I remember the first time I met him, he flew down. We were doing the Obama project for History Channel. He flew down and gave notes, and that I was like, oh boy, execs in the room from the network.
Yeah.
That I was super nervous. Nervous. I think I'm nervous because I still want to impress the dude. The dude's got like the shows that he has under his belts and stuff. So there's always like, hey, I got to show him that I'm actually intelligent. But he's seen my emails and he's spoken to me before. So he knows there's zero intelligence here.
I don't know why you would invite him to this.
Yeah, I know. This
if
mess.
If you're trying to impress him.
I'm hoping he just doesn't listen to it. I'm hoping he's doing me a solid, and he'll after today.
Wait,
he'll
even while we're interviewing him, like
I didn't tell him we're recording this. I just told him we had the Zoom and we had to talk.
Yeah, it's an open session. Yeah. I think it's fun that that he was asking about me and my name. Sorry, I'm adjusting my camera. It just shows like the level of professionalism going into it. He wants to make sure he knows all the players. He knows what's going on.
But pulling back the curtain, it's also, we haven't released any episodes when we were recording this first batch. 100%. So he would definitely listen just to check out, just because of me, he would check it out. And then because of your charming personality, he would know your name. But I will say this. So he recently had a kid. Which brings us up to your topic that you want to talk to, bad parenting.
Let's just jump into it, bad parenting. Carrie and I have
witnessed... Wait. When you were saying this, are you saying you're a bad parent? Like you're bad parenting?
It's twofold. So honestly, I think it's holistic and it's kind of the thing that we can kind of bring up regularly.
Let's bring up how many times you say holistic.
How many has it been today, do you think?
Three.
Should we keep a counter?
Three. Okay. Not cool. On the podcast, but just in general, three times today. All right, so go on, holistically.
Yep, good. Let me start with my story of what I feel is the worst parenting scenario I've ever witnessed in my life, from my perspective.
Wait, and you've personally witnessed that life?
And I'm sorry that it's you. I'm sorry that it has to be, it's not you. It's not you.
Oh, I thought you were going to call me out on this.
No, it's not you, but I knew
that pit in my stomach feeling.
You're welcome. Okay. When we were in the townhouse in Miami, next door neighbors were Jesus and Myrta and their kids. I forget the daughter's name. Maya, maybe? I forget the daughter's name.
Don't say their whole family. Do we need their...
Well, we do. Well, whatever. We can just say their son. So, I remember the son's name because of the whole situation. Okay. So, it is the night before Halloween, and Carrie and I are just home alone, in the, family room watching TV. And we hear, they're the next door neighbors, so we share the wall right next door, in the townhouse. And we hear, commotion that's going on. We don't really, some weird, you can hear stuff shuffling, you can hear, whatever, more so than normal. And then, all of a sudden, there's a knock on the back door wall that's the room's attached to, which is...
There's a fence between you
Correct. There's a fence all the way around the backyard. So somebody hopped the fence and is now knocking on the door. It's nighttime. Can't, see. Turn on the light and see it's the son. And he's probably at this point,
Were you terrified that there's a knock on the back door?
Well, of course it was. I was startled, but I wasn't like run away. You know, it was like, what is going on right now? And so, and we're right there in the room. So I just stood up, turned on the light, and I see their son, and he looks distraught. And I'm like, I open the door and I go, I call his name out, right? I'm like, what's going on? And he's so in shock. He can't talk. He's like, and I'm like, what's going on? Like, it's okay. Like, come in and pull him in. So simultaneously, while I bring him into the room, the doorbell rings at the front door, at the opposite end of the townhouse. So Carrie goes to the front door and looks and sees and opens the door. I'm with him trying to like get him to calm down to figure out what the heck is going on. And so then on the other end are Jesus and Murda with Carrie. They call his name and they're like, it's okay. Come on back. It's okay. Don't worry about it. Come on back. And so then he walks through the house to go with them. And then, so I'm over there and I'm standing there and then we're engaging in some conversation where they proceed to tell us that as a prank and a joke for night before, which usually like in Michigan, we used to call Devil's Night, right? Like as a prank, they had decided they thought it would be funny to have someone secretly come into the house, turn off the breakers on the power, right? Turn off all the power to the house so the lights went out, and proceed to have someone murder their mother in front of them.
Oh my God!
In front of them. So as a joke, as a prank to their kids. And now we're talking about probably like an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old. And so these kids witnessed what they truly thought was someone murdering their mother. And the kid freaked out so much that he ran out of the house to hop the fence to go try and get help. And Carrie and I are standing there going, okay.
You characterize this completely wrong. This is not bad parenting.
Yes, it is. 100%.
Yes, it could be categorized as bad parenting. That's just bad human. Like if you and I were living together when we were in an apartment, if someone came in and you saw him like stabbing me and then run out and I was like, ah, I gotcha.
That's not the point though. The point is that this is what parents decided to do to their kids. So when you're talking about, of course, from a human level, your statement is not incorrect, but this stood out as a talk about fucking up your kids for the rest of their life for something that you did in childhood.
There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. This is what, so listener, do you think that's bad parenting?
There's no doubt that's bad parenting.
It's the most egregious thing I've ever seen a parent do or witness or hear about, like that I was personally ended up being involved in, that their child was so in shock and scared he couldn't even speak.
You're right. You're right. It's bad parenting. I'm not defending. It's just the way you set it up. Like I thought where I thought we were going with this was the iPad. Like, is it bad parenting? Like the hacky stuff that like you would
talk. Yeah, no, it's not that. I told you, I was going to tell you the worst story. The worst.
Wait, what was your conversation after, like with Carrie? Were you both?
Yeah, we closed the door. I'm like, what the fuck? Like, we literally looked at each other and we didn't have kids at the time, right? We didn't know we were going to have a kid. But just thinking about what that did to that experience, like what that did to the kid, I was like, therapy forever.
How did the kid get out? Like, did he jump? Like,
he ran out the back door? Yes, he ran out the back door and jumped the fence and came and knocked to try and get some help.
And he's like 8 years old at the time?
Yes.
So, I mean, it's a 6-foot fence.
Yeah, but that wasn't new. They used to jump it to steal the mangoes.
Jesus. Allegedly.
No, we saw them.
I'm glad you bring these lighthearted, easy to talk about things to the table. I think about like my parenting skills and the lack thereof. Like where I think I'm kind of failing the kids is I don't make them learn kind of life lessons, you know, like, hey, here's how you change oil, or which, you know, we have an electric car, so that's not even a thing anymore. But like, or like, here's how you use this tool, or you got to every Saturday's work day for us here at the house. But we kind of like, they kind of work. Which, right. you know, when you're looking at, like, trying to build character and I guess, like, you know, if stuff gets... You, there's in life, you're going to do things you don't want to do, you know, learn that kind of stuff. Like, I think we're failing them there.
I'm on the same boat, to be honest. Like, so... and I struggle with it because my dad was so great at it, you know, from that perspective, though I hated it when I was a kid, right? Like all that I had to do.
Yeah, that's an interesting statement there. Knowing how you grew up, that's a loaded, he was great at it.
Yeah, he was great at making me have to do those things so I could learn all those things. And as a result, I do know all those things, but I hated it as a kid. I hated it. And made me, you know, despise him at a young age and all that stuff, right? That I had to do all those things.
Here's Russ. I'm going to let him. We'll continue that story in a second.
Ebb and flow. Here we go.
Hello.
Oh, look at this guy with those posters behind him.
Oh, look at that.
Come on.
Well placed.
Except, and Russ, I've told you this before, and this will drive Eric crazy. So first of all, Eric, Russ, Eric. So this is the thing that's going to drive Eric crazy because it drove me crazy on all of our calls. So you have these massive shows, like massive shows behind you. And then the one to the far right is off. It's this not one? Equal. Yeah, it's not level with the other posters.
I'm not the guy that hangs the posters around. I can take credit for a lot of things. Like I'm done. So I'll try to. Should I block it? What do I do?
No.
Just always have one hand up.
Yeah, like this. That'll be good. That's a good look. I mean, that'll really help you. Well, Russ, what a nice start to this. This is fantastic.
Yeah, thanks for calling out my OCD.
Great.
Right out of the gate.
I mean, should I show you the rest of the house? Get some other pointers?
Yeah, I'll come and redesign stuff for you. First off, Russ, thanks for doing this. It is incredibly kind of you to do this.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Let's start with, when I say like, oh, Russ McCarroll or something, I always just say like, you run all of television. Kind of responsible for some of the most iconic shows. So if you don't mind, give us your kind of 10-second background, 30-second background of who you are.
Yeah, I'll do the best thumbnail I can do. So, I mean, I got interested in TV as a kid. I had an aunt who was in the business and sort of I saw her. And
wait, who? What did your aunt do?
Her name is Wendy Walker. She used to be she had a lot of different careers or a lot of different parts of her career. But the last job she had was as executive producer of Larry King Live. So she ran Larry King Live. Her career was weird. She got started in the business with Katie Couric. They're best friends and they've known each other their whole lives. So, or I should say post college. I was lucky enough to go with her when she was actually the White House producer at the time. So I was lucky enough to go to CNN as a kid. And, you know, she and I were about the same size at that point in time. It was when I was younger. And, I just remember like all these big, huge guys were like running around. Like she would say something and they'd like run in like 9 different directions, like they're with their hair cut off. And I was like, oh, wow, big people listen to her, like meaning physically large people listen to her. And I was like, I want to do that, whatever that is. Like, that sounds great. Like ordering bigger people around. I think it was just because I was a kid and I was like, I just had this fantasy of ordering my parents around. So it was like, that's kind of what got me hooked.
That feels like a different podcast that we should have dove into that one.
Yeah, it was like, yeah. I went to college and she gave me some really good advice when I went to school. It was just like, you know, technology is going to change. All the equipment's going to change. She's like, don't bother going to school for broadcast journalism or any of that stuff. It's going to change by the time you graduate. And like, obviously, as we all know, the technology and the way in which we do our jobs has changed like 8 times since we've all been in the business. And so she was like, just focus on writing. And so I did that, on her advice. It's in school. I was a print journalism major and then, you know, got done with school and I was like, oh, this is going to be awesome. She's going to help me get a job. And she was like, I'm going to do you a favor. And I was like, what's that? She's like, I'm not going to help you get your first job. And I was like,
wow.
At the time I'm like thinking like, oh my God, like, are you kidding me? Like, and I got it. Now here I am. I'm like 21 years old and I got to find a job. And I'm like, oh, this is just awful. So I had met this guy a while before. My family's from the area near where ESPN is, in Bristol, Connecticut. And I met this guy who worked at ESPN, and I, like, this is how long ago this was. It was like, I literally would call the guy like once a week and like pester the guy for a job. I'd like physically call him on the phone and like literally like just browbeat the guy to death. And finally he was like, God, what am I going to do? It was like, I got
what you got to do.
Please tell me it was Chip Reeves.
No. Chip, it was not Chip. Chip's barely in a position to give anyone a job now, let alone back then.
Yes.
But he finally, so he calls me. I've been working at some crap job for a while, and he finally calls me. He goes, I got good news and bad news. I go, what's the good news? He goes, good news is I got a job for you. I go, well, what's the bad news? Like, that sounds pretty good. He's like, I don't work at ESPN anymore. He's like, I work at this place called the Outdoor Life Network. And I'm like, okay. I'm like, okay, not quite as good, but all right. And he's like, but don't worry, I'm going to pay you $30,000 a year. It's going to be great. And I was like, $30,000? That sounds awesome. I'm like, I'll be there. And that was my first job in TV, which was actually really great. It was a startup at the point. It was like a partnership with Times Mirror Magazine, and Roger Werner, who had actually been the CEO of ESPN, started it along with a couple other guys. And, you know, so that was my first job in TV, and it was running. I was what was called the on-air coordinator at that time. And it was like, basically I had to get all, we were all acquired programming at that point at the very beginning. And so I was basically getting all the programming in from all these disparate sources and then having to format it. But like, I literally, I'm 21 years old and I'm like working with the head of operations to create a clock for the network. And so I said to the guy who was running it, I said, look, I really want to be a producer more so than I want to be, you know, running the network. And he's like, you just remember this. He's like, you're going to come back to me at some point someday and say you made a huge mistake, but fine, go produce. And so he gave me my first gig producing, and the first thing I did was a wildlife documentary series called Wild Africa. And literally I was on a plane to Africa about 3 weeks after we had this conversation with a cameraman named Peter Henning, who had done like the American Sportsman and was like he was the lead motorcycle cameraman on the Tour de France for years. And we went to Kenya and Tanzania, he and I and Diana Nyad, for 8 weeks. To shoot this 6-part wildlife documentary series.
Wow.
And Peter's like one of the huge influences in my career. He probably taught me more than anybody, but he's like, don't ever feel like you can't ask me something. And I was like, don't have to tell me twice. And like, he basically, you know, he field produced that shoot.
It's sort of been a running theme with some people that we've talked to in terms of that. I didn't know what I was doing. Yeah. It's really interesting to me to hear successful people talk about in the beginning how they didn't know what they were doing. Like, I didn't know what I was doing, but I was figuring it out, like, you know, as I go. Like, the willingness to be able to be confident enough that I'm going to figure this thing out. Like, I'll do that, but also not be terrified to shy away from a thing I don't know, right? That willingness to just jump into that.
I think that's huge. I mean, I think especially in a business like television, where it's like, you know, look, I mean, there's some jobs where I think there's a process that goes into making those jobs, and it's a repetitive, or it's the same process again and again and again. And I think you can kind of learn those processes. But I think the first thing you learn in TV is, you know, it's a different process every single show you make. It's a different process every time you create anything. And you have to become adaptable. And I think as much as the confidence is important, because you have to be confident just to get yourself in the room. You know, without the confidence, you won't be there. But I think the second most important part of that is being willing to ask questions and listen.
Yeah. What you just described there, though, was the cameraman, was it Peter that you, that experience to me sounds like kind of what our basis is for this, you know, this podcast, is that like a defining moment. It sounds very much like going out on that first thing, being able to learn all those things and have like that kind of mentor. It sounds very defining.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, it continued on from there. You know, after that experience, you know, I did a few more things, and then it was like kind of, you know, Outdoor Life was growing, but it was growing very slowly. It was, you know, as a new network does, you know. And about 2-3 years into it, I decided that, you know, I wanted to accelerate my process and what I was doing. So I left Outdoor Life and started, you know, I went freelance and I started the first thing I did was I went to work on the Gravity, or excuse me, the Goodwill Games, you know, which was, you know, through some people I did know through my aunt. You know, I had gotten connected with a few folks at Turner Sports and sort of ended up doing stuff with those guys. And then Peter called.
Now she was willing to help?
Well, yeah. She didn't actually help me. These were people I knew from actually.
Oh, got it.
She helped in one way. She invited me to her wedding. And so I went to her wedding and I met some people at her wedding.
Like, nice. Oh, just networking, handing out business cards at the wedding.
Them and giving me a job after that. But when I was doing Goodwill, I didn't really know what I was going to do after Goodwill. And Peter called me very quickly after that and was like, hey, you know, I just got this new gig directing this project. You know, will you come help me? Can you come work on it with me? And I'm thinking, well, he must think I'm pretty great if he's calling me for this gig. Come to find out later that, you know, it was only because I spoke French that he actually wanted me to. that's neither here nor there. But we went over and we started working on a project at the time that no one really knew about, which was called Eco Challenge.
I edited some of those shows.
Did you? There you go.
Yeah, in Miami.
You probably did it after Mark took it to Discovery, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So he took it away from Discovery. Like when I worked on the show, it was on Discovery, and
gotcha.
We as employee, I was hired by Discovery Studios, and so we did Morocco, Argentina, and New Zealand. We did those versions of it. But I started off as the associate director, and then by the second year, I was show running, and that was like another.
Oh, wow, okay.
So I did that for a long time, and then. You know, Mark decided, you know, right after Survivor's like massive success, that he wanted to move Eco Challenge to a different network, and took it to USA. And at that time, I was doing a lot of freelance work. I was doing a lot of freelance sports work. Ironman, Iditarod, NBA basketball, Major League Baseball, all sorts of just different, you know, ball and sports games, and was going to be working on the Olympics, and went to see Dick Ebersol at NBC because... you know, he had reached out just to say, hey, could we catch up? And I'd done a bunch of freelance stuff for those guys at some point. Or I can't remember if I asked him to meet, or I don't remember how I ended up in the room. But I ended up in the room with him, and it was shortly after 9/11. I'd been in Australia doing the Goodwill Games, the next version of the Goodwill Games, and on 9/11 was flying, actually, in 9/11, which was like a terrifying experience for my family because, you know, I landed in... in LA on 9/11, and literally got a call through to my brother and was like, hey man, I'm in LA, I'm good, you know. But long story short, after that happened, I ended up in Ebersol's office somehow, and he just basically said to me, he's like, hey, can you help out the news division? They're getting ready for the games, but everybody's like just kill, you know, is doing aftermath coverage, and there's no bodies down there. And I said, sure. So I went downstairs and, you know, started working with the news guys to like sort of help them prep for Salt Lake. I was like literally doing packages about bobsledders and things like that, and ended up, you know, cutting the open for the show a couple of days. Like they were like, they wanted to have sports heavy opens. And so I cut a couple opens for them, you know, obviously not as the editor, but as the producer. And the executive producer of the show at the time was a guy named Jonathan Wald, who now runs primetime for MS and CNBC and all that stuff. Jonathan's actually a great guy, you know, known him for a long time. He's like, hey, could you stick around and like work with us instead of going back to sports? And I was like, you can call Mr. Ebersol and you can be damn sure Mr. Ebersol and ask him anything you want to. That's totally fine with me. I had no problem. And he did. And he was like, Ebersol was like, who are you talking about? Like, yeah, whatever you want. Like, no big deal. So I stayed on and worked with those guys through Salt Lake and then ended up at the Today Show for about 4 years. And worked with, I kind of didn't really work with Katie, it was a little too close for comfort. So I worked mostly with, I did some stuff with all the other guys, but I worked a lot with Al and Ann specifically, Curry. And so did that for about 4 years, which was an amazing kind of great experience. But it was kind of like the longer it kind of went on after 9/11, the more it got to be back to like what I think everybody knows the Today Show as, which is like, mm-hmm. a lot of concerts on the plaza, a lot of cooking segments, a lot of those kinds of things that, you know, while they're amazing, they probably are not my strong suit doing them. So I left and sort of went back to the freelance world and, you know, did one of my favorite gigs after that, which was I spent about 3 years working on the NHL. And I would do all the preseason interviews with all the players and all the interviews right before the playoffs with all the players. So I'd literally fly around the country, talk to hockey players for like a month and a half before the hockey season, and then do it again, like right before the playoffs started. So it was like, you know, I love hockey. I'm a huge hockey fan. So it was like,
I was just going to say, were you a fan before that started? Well, and it was,
I loved it. I mean, I love sports in general. Rick knows this. But like working on the NBA, it would be like, you know, you'd have to go interview, like, didn't matter who it was, you know, Nowitzki, right? Like, Nowitzki was a pain in the ass. Like, he never wanted to do an interview. Like, he never wanted to do sound in, like, at halftime or at the end of a game. Like, it was always pulling teeth. You know, you're relying on the PR guys from these teams, and they're getting pulled in nine different directions. It was awful. The hockey guys were like, where do you want me to stand, and how long do you need me for? And like, they're like, and like, I'm doing interview questions with them, and they like kind of look at me after about 2 seconds. They're like, you actually know something about our sport. Like, you're actually talking about actual hockey.
So you're the one that knows something about hockey.
And literally, that's how I got the job. Like, literally, a guy that I used to work with 100 years ago was like, we should send Russ to do the interviews, because like, he had season tickets to the Rangers. So like, literally the only reason I did it was because I had like two really cheap seats at MSG for like 4 years, where I like went to every game for 4 years. So anyway, but it was a great gig, and I did that for a while. And then, after, you know, a couple more years of doing freelance, I started dating my wife, and she was like, kind of like, I literally would leave to do the NBA playoffs in April. And then I'd be gone until I got back from Hawaii in like November. I'd do Ironmans and baseball and football and all sorts of stuff for like 4 or 5 months. And she was finally like, look, dude, I know you like this road thing, but like, I'm not so good with you being gone for like 5 months at a time. And so I started like trying to find a full-time job, and then got called by a woman I worked with at NBC, who is still, you know, another one who like sort of like, you have all these people that help you in your career. Her name is Jamie Gangel. She was the national correspondent for the Today Show for a long time. And she called me and she's like, oh, you know, my friend Nancy just took over the History Channel. She's looking for some people. You know, you know anybody that would be interested in talking to her? I was like, yeah, me? Yeah. So I went and talked to her and, you know, interviewed with her and a couple other people over there. And it turned out that, like, you know, one of the guys had worked for the executive that was our lead executive at Discovery back in the day. And then obviously I had the recommendation from Jamie at NBC. So Nancy's like, hey, you know, come work with us. You know, we're doing some great things here. And we're, you know, they had just launched Ice Road Truckers when I got there.
What'd you get hired for?
I was hired as an executive producer. So that my first job there was executive producer. So I was overseeing shows and stuff like that, which was super easy. Like, the overseeing shows stuff was easy because it was basically just post-production work. You know, it's like, you know, they send you a cut, you give notes on the cut. You know, it was pretty straightforward. What I had no idea, and I think this might have actually had part of the reason why I got the job in the first place, was like the first time I interviewed Nancy, I'm like, I like know nothing about development. And she looked at me and she goes, don't worry, I got plenty of people here with freaking ideas. I just don't have anybody that knows how to make a show. So she hired me literally just to make shows. And like, she was like, you know, I need some people that can actually make a show that actually makes sense, as opposed to like, so it was like the very beginning of that time. And then, you know, sort of we went on a bit of a roll after that with, you know, Pawn Stars and Pickers launched a couple years after I got there. And we just had that sort of amazing run where we actually at one point became the number one cable network in television, which, you know, History had never been above the like 25th as a network.
The idea behind the show is like a defining moment, and it could be personal or career, but because of the breadth of what you've done, I'd love to start with career. And if you want to talk personal, we can get there. But what's the kind of defining moment for you that if you would have went one way, your career goes a different way, but you chose this way, you know, what's that moment? And then I kind of want to dissect what that moment actually means.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's hard to pick one. Cause I think for me, it's a series of like, I, you know, it could have been that moment when Mr. Ebersol said to me, "Hey, look, you know, can you go help out the news division after 9/11?" And I could have said very easily, you know, I'm a sports guy. That's not something I do. And like, you know, it's not where my head's at and stuff like that. And, you know, and I met some people that are still good friends of mine today there. You know, the guy that runs the studio at A&E right now, the unscripted studio at A&E, he was my AP at the Today Show. And I would have never known him. And like, so not only would that have changed my career, it would have changed his career. It would have changed many other people's careers, but that's in, you know, there's those kinds of moments, I think. But probably if I had to pick one, it was probably, you know, getting lucky enough to have Nancy hire me at History. You know, I didn't really have the credentials that most of the people that took that job had. You know, I hadn't done development. I hadn't worked in that industry, in that part of the business. And she sort of took a flyer on me. I mean, she knew I could handle the show work because I'd done that. So it wasn't like she hired somebody that was a complete novice. But, you know, I ended up developing some pretty big shows for them and ended up doing some stuff for them that I don't think that necessarily they or even I knew was going to happen when I got there.
So if you could dive into that, like she took a flyer on me, right? Like that scenario, like how did that play out? What was that process like, right? For her to get to that point, you know, conversationally or build up to, or any, you know, can you dive into that yet?
Yeah. I mean, I think anybody that knows Nancy knows that she's pretty definitive. Once she kind of makes up her mind, it's like, you know, it's really hard to move her off of it. But, you know, and then you get there and then it's like, okay. And I remember saying to my wife, because my wife and I were, I don't think we were quite engaged yet, but we were certainly dating at that point. I remember saying to her, I was like, oh, I don't know what I've got myself into. Because like, this wasn't like, hey, we're going to go do a show and then we're going to go, you know, and then the show's going to be over and we're going to go our separate ways and we're going to all, you know, keep doing it. Or we're going to go to post and we're going to sit in an edit room. And like, this is like a different beast. Like this was completely out of my comfort zone. And so I remember saying to her at one point, I'm like, I don't know if I know what I got myself into. Cause it's like, you go to these meetings and you sit in these rooms with these people and they all start talking. And I never forget. And this was one of the things I'm always thankful to Nancy for. We're in this like offsite meeting where it's like, I think at the time there were 3 vice presidents, there were 10 executive producers and like about 10 support staff plus Nancy and David. So it was probably like 25 people in this room and everybody's going around and they're all talking about what they think and how they feel and, you know, where the industry is, where the business is. And I just remember she sat down next to me at one point and she goes, "They're not as smart as they think they are." I think is what she said. She's like, it just takes time. And like the thing that I was that's so great about her and the way that she ran that business for as long as she ran that business was she had very little expectations of you for the first year. Like she kind of knew that it took you time to sort of get there,
that's awesome.
Figure it out. Yeah. And like, you know, and like she would say openly, she'd be like, "Look, if you're still in the same spot, you know, a year from now, we're gonna have some issues. Like it's not gonna, this isn't a free ride." But she's like, "You got to relax and let it, you know, and figure it out." And like, so much of what I thought walking in the door at that place, I was like, you know, we're gonna do this, and we're gonna do that, we're gonna do the other thing, and it's like it was all wrong, almost all of it was wrong. Like, you know, and you know, again, it comes back to that thing of having the confidence to take the job in the first place, but then also having the foresight to like sort of at least take a step back and listen. And you know, look, I like to talk as much as anybody, but like I spent my first 6 months there and they were worried about me at one point. They're like, he doesn't say anything. Wow. Anything. I didn't talk a lot the first 6 months I was there. I just listened and was trying to figure things out.
Russ, can you kind of talk from a network perspective? Like, we've never actually explained the process of selling a show. So, like, you put a sizzle reel together, you put a deck together, and then we bring it to someone like you, and we say, "Hey, please buy this show." Can you talk about, A, is it competitive from every executive side? Like, what is the process from the network? How does it go from the idea to on television? If you kind of, you know, give your 2 cents on that.
Yeah, I can tell you. Like, I mean, look, the great thing about the time that I'm talking about at History was you had – probably 6 or 7 or 8 executives who all helped create hit shows. And we were all super competitive with each other. So like you bring your idea to me. There's somebody else bringing ideas to all of them. And we would go to these, what were called team meetings. So each vice president had a team that they worked with exclusively, and they would get together and they would talk through the ideas and they would decide what they wanted to talk about in the bigger room. And then we'd all get together, all three teams, all of us would get together and we'd all have ideas. Then we'd talk about all of our ideas. And, you know, you'd go to those meetings, you'd pitch out those ideas, and then the VPs would get together with David, who's the senior vice president, and they would decide what we were going to move forward with. What are we going to do pilots of? What are we going to develop further? What are we going to go to series on? And you know, those decisions would come back at us when I was at the junior level. Eventually, you know, I got to a level where I was making those decisions on what we were going to move forward with. But you know, you have to be able to go in the room. So you're selling to that person that's taking the pitch from you. That person then turns around and is selling up the food chain. Right. They're selling to their vice president just to get it in the bigger room. Then they're selling to their senior vice president, who's going to make the decision about whether the project gets moved forward. And ultimately, it's going to go to the head of the network, which was Nancy at the time. And she's going to decide, OK, now you guys really like this idea. Am I willing to put money against it? Am I willing to spend money on this project? Do I agree with you that I think that it's worth us, you know, actually writing a check for? So it's a multi-tiered process, and then you get the then once you get the show across the line and you're moving in the right direction, then it becomes okay. Now we got to make the show, right? Like now we've sold it. Now we have to go do it, right? And that's where the tough stuff would come into play, right? Like that's where it would be like, okay, now I'm working with you, Rick, and we're gonna make a show, and like, what does that mean? And what does that look like? And how are we going to do it? And, you know, and not only that, but then, okay, here comes the first cut. And like the first cut's a fucking mess. And so.
Did Rick do it? Right. Be honest.
Yeah. If I did, it's a fucking mess.
Rick's shows weren't a mess. And he and I didn't actually do that many shows together, but I do remember coming down to see him in Austin in that rat infested, office that was like, I was like, fearful that something was going to drop out of the drop ceiling on me at all times.
It literally was rat infested. And it's funny because, you know, when like when you tell people, oh, we're in television stuff, you think like glitz and glamour. And then, you know, there's literally rats running around in the ceiling. And
yeah, there were very few situations where I went into a production company's offices and I was like, ooh, these are nice.
That's right.
Do I feel comfortable sitting down here? And like, should I eat any of the stuff that's out? Because it feels like it might have been out for a couple of days. Like I don't know what I want to do.
Russ, how many sizzles or ideas are you allowed to bring? Was there ever a limit, or was there not enough? And then the kind of follow up question is if you're not selling shows, and it could just be happenstance, right? There's only so much money to go around. Were people fired because their shows are not getting on the air?
No, I mean it was very. Like we were at that point in time, like when I was at that level, there wasn't really a lot of people getting fired because we were doing so well. I mean, we were like climbing up. We'd go from, you know, the second year I was there, third year I was there, we like, you know, I did a show called The White House Behind Closed Doors, which basically George Bush and Laura Bush let us into the White House to shoot behind the scenes with them. And, you know, we were thinking it was kind of a throwaway, like, you know, 2 hours, you know, the night before Thanksgiving. And the thing did like, you know, there was like 1.5 million people in the demo and like 7 million people total watching it. And it was like, holy cow. Like, and like, we just started doing those shows again and again and again. So we were like, you know, we moved up, I think the first year I was there from like 25th to 15th, then 15th to like 12th, and then like 8th and 6th and 4th, and then like 2nd and 1st, you know, like, so we were just on this like crazy trajectory. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't so much like if the shows didn't work, you were, you know, people were moving you out, but like you were definitely like, if you were successful, like you were moving up, like that was more of the case. Yeah. Like, so, you know, I mean, Mary Donahue did Pawn Stars like the first or second, probably second or third year I was there, and like, boom, she was promoted. And then, you know, other people started doing other hit shows and boom, they were promoted. And like, then I, you know, I remember it was like right after I did Mountain Men, because that was like, Mountain Men premiered at like a 1.9 in the demo and like a 5 million in the 5 million overall. It was like a top 10 show right out of the gate. But that, you know, so then, you know, so we all started moving up and stuff like that. And then, like, you know, look, as is always the case, the bell curve gets crossed and, you know, it starts to go down.
one of the things I've really learned from you was what you kind of just said about that you're not making shows for you, and that it changes the approach of our sales tape across the board. And I think that's one of the most vital things when we now look at what, because our bandwidth, we only have so much bandwidth to take on other people's ideas to actually develop and to bring to networks. So it's all right. We want to go to like history, discovery, all these ideas of networks that this could go. But then we have to actually look at what the demo is, how to actually make it. And then you would always say things like, all right, you know, mail programming. This is a mail programming network. You have to have A, B, C, and D in there. You would give us very specific notes and be like, this right there, you have to change to say this, you know, and then we have success doing that from it. So it is interesting to actually see that advice play out.
Yeah, it's funny because when I originally took the job at History, I remember when I finally, you know, like I said, I took a pay cut. So I was like trying to justify this to myself. And I'm like, finally, I'm like, well, look, let me just go take this job for like 2 years and then I'll come back to the producing side, but I'll know a lot more. Like I'll understand a lot more what the sales process is like. And it 100% is true. Now, granted, those jerks kept giving me a better job and more money. And so I ended up staying on that side for 12 years. You know, I don't know that it paid off as quickly as it should have, but you definitely get a different insight.
On the note of notes, I want to bring up something that Rick and I touched on before you jumped on, Russ, which was Rick talked about how the first show that he was working on that you came to and would give notes on. How
Best nervous, or Rat Infested Place.
How nervous. Well, now that I know it was Rat Infested, it makes even more sense. But he talked about how nervous he was about that in the sense of, you know, your position, who you were, and how, you know, as part of that process, it made him, you know, nervous. I almost said holistically. But he also talked about how helpful it was. It was eye-opening for you that your notes, how effective they were, and how it, you know, was part of that process. So Rick, I don't know if you want to expand any further on some of that, you know, that initial.
Yeah, I think I threw up twice before you got there because I was so nervous. And then
you knew that now. If you knew, now that you know me, you'd be like, oh God, he's cool.
No, I'm still nervous. It's funny because like your advice, it's interesting. I always strategically call you when I need advice on certain aspects and things. And which is always weird because I always feel bad because I'm like, all right, I'm going to call Russ for this 2-minute conversation. It'll be real quick. Please. And then we end up talking for like a half hour because you bring up how great the Pistons are and the Lions are and how the Miami Heat should win the title and then how bad hockey is. And so we end up talking about everything but what I actually called you for.
Start talking about the Lions gambling situation, we could do that, but I think that's a different podcast.
Well, this leads into exactly what Rick just brought up here and kind of what you guys are riffing on. Brings up something that's a very clear connector between everything that you just talked about, Russ, which is the relationships. At every point of everything you just discussed, it was about people, right, along the way. And so what I'm curious about is have you found trying to work on those relationships or work with other people, does that come easy to you, or is that something you actively have worked toward in order to leave good impressions with people and create the good relationships? And part B to that is, have you had a lot of experiences where you were unable to get along with some people and they didn't end up into relationships? Does that happen?
Oh, we want names. We want names, email addresses.
I'll answer the second part first real fast, and then I'll come back to it, which is that, yes, I've definitely had issues with getting along with people from certain instances and I'll come back to that. But I think, you know, Peter Henning, who's the guy I told you about, who I went to Africa with, the cameraman way back at the beginning, like he had such a huge effect on me. And you know, look, if I had to, you know, create my own Mount Rushmore of influences on me, you know, he and Nancy would definitely be on it. I'd probably have to figure out who the other two were, but those two for sure. You know, Peter said, you know, I worked with Peter on and off for a good 6 or 7 years, right? And multiple times every year for 6 or 7 years. And after about the first 2 or 3 years, you know, he would never let me pay for anything. Like I drink, dinner, like didn't matter. He would just never. And then finally I said to him, I was like, you gotta let me pay for something, man. I'm an adult. And he's like, no, he's like, you can pay me, but here's how I want you to pay me. He's like, I want you to take care of the next generation of people, the people that are younger than you. I want you to be good to them. I want you to give advice to them. I want you to go out of your way to help people. Like, that's what I want you to do to repay me for having done that for you, is to do it that way. And so
that's great.
I've always sort of taken that to heart with Peter. And so I will get on the phone with anyone. I will talk to anyone. I will give them my advice. I'll give them my 2 cents. I will spend time with them. I will always do that, because he went out of his way to do that for me to such an extent that, you know, I could never repay him. And that's what he asked me to do, to repay him. So I take that very seriously. And I'm, you know, it's just on the, my aunt just asked me the other day to get on the phone with an editor, who she knows, who lives in LA, who's like trying to look for some advice. So I spent 40 minutes on the phone with him. And as much as that's because she asked me to do it, it's also because of Peter.
It's incredible. You talking about that literally just gave me chills. That pay it forward, that mentality of, geez, talk about defining moments.
That's him telling me that. And I'll never forget, we were in Georgetown and we'd just come from a meeting at Discovery, and, you know, we were out to dinner for the nth time with, you know, the network executive at the time. And, you know, he picked up the check again, and I was just like, come on, you gotta, you know, let me, you know, and that's what he said to me. And like, you know, so anyway, I've taken that very seriously. But I think as far as the, you know, not getting along and having a tough time with some relationships, I think that comes with the business. I think it comes a little bit with my personal approach, which is I'm pretty honest and straightforward. I don't really pull punches or tell you something's great and then turn around and tell you it's not, you know, like that's just not me. And I think that's hard for some people to take. I think the straightforwardness is really hard. And I think in certain cases that damages relationships. And I think I've tried to get better at that as I've gotten older, to not be so, I guess, to use a little sugar along with the medicine, you know, kind of thing. And that philosophy and, you know, Elaine Frontaine Bryant, who runs A&E, was probably the person that taught me that the best. You know, like, I've never ever worked with anyone in my entire career who, like, she can go into a room with you and you've been working on a project for her for 6 or 8 months, and it's like you've been killing yourself to create this great tape and this great whole thing, and it's all wonderful. And she'll literally pass in the room, but you'll walk out of the room and you'll think it was the greatest meeting of all time, and you love her more after she's passed on your project than you did before you walked in the room. And it was like, it was so like eye-opening for me when I worked with her to like sort of see how she did that. And it'd be like, you know, she'd start off and she'd like, you know, sort of touch your hand, and she'd be like, sweetheart, I love you. I love you to death. Not going to make the show, but I love you. And like, what are we going to do? And what are we going to work on next? And like, she just had a great way of doing it. And I think, you know, so I think those things do happen. And there's definitely people that I've, you know, sort of, you know, it's a little bit harder as you get older too, because you naturally lose touch with people, right? Like, it's just like, you know, people have kids, people have lives, that stuff happens. And it's like, you can't keep in touch with everybody you've ever met in your entire life, or else that's all you do. But I think there's definitely the straightforwardness is sometimes tough. But yeah, I mean, look, I've been very lucky with mentors and people that have helped.
You said that a couple of times along the way here, but there's no way that you didn't get all of these calls or the connections of when the call happened and there's other people you worked with that were willing to, you know, speak on your behalf or that kind of thing. There's no way you didn't create a whole ton of good relationships along the way. And you know, that had to have dominated the situation for you to be as successful and be able to be where you're at and mention as many people as you have in that process.
I mean, look, I think good is like the baseline, right? Like, if you're not good, you're not going to be working in the business at all. So you have to be able to do the work. But I think on top of the work, you know, you've got to get some breaks. And I've been very, very lucky with a lot of different folks to get those things. And look, you know, it's, you know, it, I hope it goes both ways. You know, I know with, you know, the Texas Crew guys, you know, we worked together, you know, I hired those guys to shoot on Eco Challenge, you know, when I was show running that, you know, I hired those guys to make shows at History. We worked together on stuff after I left. Like, I think it goes both ways in a lot of cases. And, you know, like I've known David, who Rick works with. And David and I have known each other. I knew David before he was married, which I think nobody can even imagine, because he's now got one in college and one on his way to college. And he's been married for 20 some years. And we've known each other since probably 1996, 97, something like that. And we're still good friends. And, you know, I think it's important too, though. I think it's like, you, there's one part we didn't touch on, which I think is even more important, which is, it just made me think of that, which is, you know, you don't know who the person you're, who's working for you now, what they're going to be doing in the future. And
absolutely,
I think that was the other thing that Peter really imparted on me, is like, you know, take care of your crew, take care of your team, you know, be the person that takes the brunt of the difficulty, you know, because you don't know where they're going to be in the future. You don't know if they're going to be your boss someday, or if they're going to be, you know, in a position to, you know, help you, or if they're just going to be somebody that, you know, that, that you can work alongside of for a long, long time. And it's like, you know, I always thought it was super important to take care of my crew.
The number of people I've talked to, they were like, oh, if I had told you, you know, that what happened there, and now they're my boss type scenario, it happens in real life.
There's a guy I worked at, there's a guy I worked with at History where he was my boss at one point, and then I became his boss, you know, and like, think about that dynamic. And that was in a near period of time, you know, like you know, the paradigm can flip really pretty easy.
Oh yeah.
Russ, I have a couple things before we let you go that you'll indulge me. One is, can you talk about Hatfield and McCoys, how that came about?
Yeah. I mean, Hatfield and McCoys was super interesting. I mean, it was, you know, let me first say that, like, I was not the creative executive on that. I did not work on it, but, I was there and obviously was a part of, you know, a lot of the discussions that went on. So, Leslie Greif, who's a producer who, you know, has done a million different things. He did the Godfather show that was on Paramount not that long ago. I can't remember.
I'm just watching out The Offer.
Yeah. He did The Offer.
I started it last night.
Yeah.
Unbelievable show.
Yeah, so Leslie did that. He did Texas Ranger. He's done, like, he's been a scripted guy forever, but he made a lot of unscripted shows, including Gene Simmons' Family Jewels, and so he was always in and around the A&E offices, and doing a million shows for us. And he really wanted to make, you know, he really wanted to get back into doing some scripted stuff at some point in his career. And so, you know, he'd been talking to a lot of different people, and you know, he wrote a script along with, I can't remember who the guy that was that wrote the actual script, but he and Leslie worked on the script together, and they somehow, you know, they got it to a point, and we were kind of playing around with, should we do scripted? Should we not do scripted? Is it the right thing for us? Is it not? But, like, you know, if you look around and you look at the landscape, you know, whether it's the Americans on FX or, you know, Vikings, or there's just so much historical fiction content out there that it didn't make sense for us not to get into it. And so Nancy commissioned the script, and they wrote it, and they delivered the script. And I remember everybody kind of reading it and being like, it's a good script. It's a really good script. And there was, like, some hemming and hawing about, like, whether or not we were going to do it or not. And somehow Leslie, to his credit, and I, you know, he's been in Hollywood forever, so he has all these connections. He got the script to Kevin Costner. And Kevin read the script in a weekend, and he was like, I love it. I'll do it. Don't change a word. I'll only do it if you don't change a word. Right.
Wow.
And so that came back to Nancy, and Nancy's like, well, look, we can get Kevin Costner to do a scripted show on our network. And it's like a Western, and it's like exactly what everybody wants from him. And, so they greenlit the show. And like, all of a sudden we were doing scripted, and there's an executive who's now at MGM. His name is Arturo Interian. Arturo is probably, along with Steve Stark, who's also at MGM, or used to be at MGM, but now is at Toluca. And they just did Wednesday for Netflix, those two guys. But Arturo was working at Lifetime at the time and doing scripted movies. He'd started off on CBS Movie of the Week and stuff like that. And they were like, all right, well, now we're going to do Hatfield and McCoys. We better get somebody in that actually, like, kind of knows what we're doing. So Arturo gets brought over from Lifetime, and he worked with Dirk Hoekstra, and they sort of, like, came up with this plan of how to do this. And, like, you know, they shot in Romania, and, you know, the whole thing got put together in Canada, and, like, everybody's looking at the show, and, like, it's really great. And I remember going to the premiere, and the premiere was awesome, and it was like, we all loved the show, but, like, we didn't know, like, how it was going to perform. And then, like, of course, we put it on, I think it was Memorial Day weekend in 12 or something like that. It might have been 11 or 12, something like that, right around then. But it went on Memorial Day weekend, and it did, like, humongous numbers, like the biggest, you know, cable numbers of all time at that point. And it just, it absolutely exploded. And I think, like, within, like, a week, Nancy was, like, named, like, you know, CEO in waiting. So she went from being like the president of history to be like CEO of the entire corporation, like overnight. And like Dirk got promoted and like, you know, the network exploded. And then like, you know, all of a sudden we're doing like 10 scripted projects. And in fact, I did, you know, four scripted projects when I was there. You know, we're, and all of a sudden we were like a, you know, but it was amazing. But, you know, no one, you know, as with all those hits, like you kind of feel like they're good and that they're going to break through and they're going to do well. But anybody that tells you they know is like so full of that. And in fact, you know, Nancy did one thing amongst the many things she did one other thing that I always thought was really awesome was we would do toasts to shows before they premiered because she wanted us to toast the quality of the show, not the rating and not the, you know, so it was all about the process.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. It was all about the process. So you do, if your show was going to premiere on Sunday, we'd do a toast on Friday night and we'd toast the show. And sometimes it turned out to be Happy Hills and McCoys and sometimes it weren't turned out to be other shows, but you know,
Dark Files. Is that what you're saying?
Dark Files might not. I don't know if Dark Files qualified for a toast. It was, you know, But I don't remember.
You said your biggest dream is to do a show with Dave Matthews, right? And have me direct it.
There it is.
That's the ask, Russ. The real reason why you're on here.
Just an hour and 5 minutes to get there.
Just Dave Matthews? Just Dave Matthews?
Just me in a room with Dave Matthews. That's all we need. White backdrop.
I'm sure we can figure that out. I mean, you know, he's an entertaining guy. I'm surprised he actually hasn't done a show.
Russ, do you have a hard out, or can I ask you one more question?
No, please.
Which is really a two-parter.
I'm all yours. I didn't know if you, for as long as you guys need me.
So at this point, like in your career and life, like what keeps you up at night and what gets you out of bed in the morning?
Well, I mean, I think the thing that keeps me up at night, which Rick knows, is I have an 18-month-old. So the
crying keeps him up at night.
It's not the crying. It's like, you know, the idea that, you know, the college is probably going to be like $1 million a year by the time he gets there. And like, you know, it's
just so that, parenting the whole,
yeah. Well, just, you know, just the idea that like, you know, as much as my career may have been long at this point, it's going to go on for a lot longer because I've got him. So I got to, you know, and it is a little bit, you know, that same thing that you guys talked about before. It's like, you know, we got to sell. We all have to sell. Like on this side of the business, you've got to sell and you've got to keep selling and you've got to keep, you know, coming up with new ideas and doing that. And so, you know, I think it's that sort of constant need to be ahead of the game and just, you know, staying out in front of yourself so you know you got that runway coming. So I think that's oftentimes what keeps me up at night is that. But I think the thing that gets me up in the morning and that gets me going is like, look, I never really wanted to do anything else other than make TV shows. I mean, I've always loved television. I've loved television since I was a kid. Like, I mean, if my parents had let me, I would have never moved out from in front of the TV. I would have never done half the things I did if they had let me. You know, I could have sat there and watched Togan's Heroes reruns for 7 days, you know. That was the show that I fell in love with, you know, the first time I, you know, turned on the television, you know, was, you know, that those guys running across the, you know, the doormat with the title of the show on it and, you know, going in different directions as coming out, like, you know, like that, you know, that show, you know, even Captain Kangaroo, you know, like those are the things that I remember as a kid, like falling in love with that medium. And, you know, I never really had a desire to do anything else other than tell stories and sort of bring, you know, people the same level of, you know, enjoyment and fun that I got out of it. So, you know, to be able to do that as an adult is an honor and a privilege. And look, I've been in the Oval Office. I stood in there, you know, by myself at one point because they forgot that I was in there. And, you know, for a kid like me who grew up and was born in Connecticut to end up in that situation and, you know, be able to see the stuff and go to the places that I've been to. I mean, I traveled the world with Iron Man and with Eco Challenge. You know, I spent months in Morocco and New Zealand and Argentina and Chile and, you know, all over the world. It's like, That's a pretty special experience to get to have. And so that's what wakes me up every morning. And that's what gets me going every morning is like, you know, the opportunity to do that again for one more day and get to have one more of those amazing experiences and, you know, go to the Olympics and go to the Super Bowl. You know, I mean, I'll never forget, you know, talking to Tom Brady with Melissa Stark right after, you know, they beat the Eagles in the Super Bowl. I mean, like that was pretty amazing, you know, like I'm standing there and, you know, I'm shaking hands with Tom Brady, you know, 10 minutes after the Super Bowl is over, you know.
That's awesome.
What did you find where you kind of, you had an idea about parenting and now that you're parenting, what do you find that's different?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, look, I think the thing that you can't appreciate as a parent is the idea that like everybody tells you like it's this life-changing experience and it's so amazing. And like until you do it, like you can't, like everybody's skeptical. You're like, yeah, it's not really that. That's not really what it is. And then you do it and you're like, oh yeah, they're kind of all right. But you there's no way to have a frame of reference for it until you're in it. I think that was one thing. I think the other thing was like no one really told me about the amount of diapers. I mean, I knew there was diapers. I just didn't maybe know there was as many of them. You know, that's another thing. But I mean, look, in fact, David's the one that said this to me. He's like, once you have the kid, you'll watch the kid like a movie. And I was like, that seems odd. Like, I'm not going to pay attention that much. And like, you do. You watch him like he's a movie and you watch him all the time. And it's thoroughly enjoyable to you. I don't know that anybody else really cares what your kid's doing, but like for you.
I don't show pictures of my kids because no one cares like I do because I don't care about their kids.
Yeah,
but I'll say this, the fear, that's the one thing that I like, that just the fear, the constant fear, like whether it be at they're at school, like, you know, oh, they're not here, you know, they're gone or you hear a thump from upstairs. You're like, oh, here we go.
My little guy's still pretty small, so he's not off on his own yet. So I'm sure that will become more pronounced. And I also am very lucky. I have a wife who when she's around, like all the fear goes out of my head because I'm like, I know she's like on top of this. She's like white on rice, like she's on top of it. Like she's like, you know, when she's not around, I worry a lot. But when she's around, I don't worry.
Yeah.
So Russ, when it comes to kids, I would like to steer you away from pranking them.
What did you do? He's like, oh my, no, it's not. So he started the podcast today with like, let's talk about bad parents. Well, go ahead and tell him what happened.
No, bad parenting moment.
Bad parenting
moment.
Okay.
Is what I thought.
But Russ, you have something in your head on what that means. And then he drops this stupid thing.
Go ahead. We talked about bad parenting for at least a half hour before we got on with
you. Awesome. Which we're going to cut down to about 2 minutes.
When we were in Miami, in this townhouse, the neighbors, our next door neighbors, so we shared the wall with them. It was in the evening. It was dark. We were watching, Carrie and my wife and I were watching TV. And we heard like
noise. The night before Halloween.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. The night before Halloween. Yep. And so we heard like commotion, like, you know, next door, but it's all muffled and whatever. We're like, oh, that's a little bit weird. You know, it was out of the ordinary, whatever the commotion was we were hearing. And then all of a sudden we get like, there's a knock on the door wall of the family room that we're in, like literally we're right next to it. Yeah. In the backyard and the backyard, which is fenced in entirely. Right. And I went, oh, that's interesting. And so I like stood up and turned on the light and it's the son of the next door neighbor. So they have two kids. So the parents have like probably about a 10 and a 5, 10 and an 8-year-old ish. And the son, the 8-year-old, is standing there and I turn on the light and I'm like, Johnny, what's going on? And he's sobbing. He is just like just utterly, and he's in such shock. He literally can't get words out of his mouth.
Oh my God.
He's like, and just like, and I'm like, Johnny, what's going on? What's the matter? Like, what's wrong? And so I can't get him to say anything. Simultaneously, our doorbell rings at the other end of the house, right? And so Carrie goes over to open the door. Yeah. And then shortly after, it turns out it's the neighbors. It's the parents of the kid. Yep. And so they're just over there like, oh, Johnny, it's not a big deal. Come on, just come on back over, whatever. And so I like usher him through the house, like to his parents, in which case when they are wrapping everything up. They're like, oh, you know, it's okay. It's not a problem, whatever. They get them out. And they're like, yeah, we decided to pull a prank on our kids for tonight. So we actually had one of our friends come over and they turned off, they turned off the circuit breakers and to kill all the lights in the house. And they came in and pretended to murder the mom. In front of the kids.
In the front of their kids.
In front of their kids. They thought that that was going to be funny and a joke.
So this kid I mean, escapes.
I've seen the things where the Grinch comes in, and I think that's tough. But like that's
tough too. Crazy. But watching your mom get killed, the kid escapes, hops the fence, goes through the thing, and they're just like, eh, whatever. No, but here's the thing.
No wonder he can't talk.
Exactly. They literally thought he just saw his mom get murdered. I was like. Oh my gosh!
But this is what Eric. This is the lighthearted podcast that we have with Eric. He's Listen. Like bad parenting. That's not bad parenting. That's just bad human. Like
that's borderline psychotic. That's crazy.
It is.
Psychotic.
I don't disagree with you. That all that just feeds into the fact it was really bad parenting.
I mean, yeah, that's like different level. Like, I mean, I feel bad when I see the Grinch videos because I'm like, oh, that kid doesn't know what's going on. But like, this is like awful. This is terrible.
Awful. Terrible. Awful. Yeah. Worst thing I've ever seen or known about that a parent has done to a kid.
Yeah, I mean,
no, like willingly.
Luckily, I'm still in the peekaboo phase, so like I'm like, I'm like, to graduate to the, like faking his mom's death.
Wow.
Dark.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's crazy.
So the problem is we're going to have to keep that story now because that is such a funny line, Russ.
Yeah. Well, sorry, I didn't mean to ruin it.
No, it's crazy. It's crazy.
I mean, I got to go tell my wife this story because she's going to be like, Everything I do after this will seem not that bad.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. We closed the door right after we're ready to leave, and Carrie and I looked at each other like, like, what did we just like on a human level? We didn't have a kid at that time. We didn't even know we were going to have a kid or whatever. The whole thing. On a human level, and the psychological damage that we just witnessed happening to children right in front of us. Right. I was like, I don't even know how.
There's a reason why that family was vacationing by themselves because none of the other families.
Yeah, every time they try and pull this off.
Vacation with the Joneses, they're out. You know? So, too funny.
All right, well, Russ, thank you so much. Your stories are incredible.
And Eric, we'll hopefully see you sometime at some point. I'm going to get to work on the Dave Matthews Show right now. So
yeah, please do. Get back to me once you have
Tease him. Don't tease him and don't encourage him. It's all bad.
Double-edged sword, Derek. It's a double-edged sword. All right, guys.
Awesome. Thanks, Russ.
Okay, guys, talk to you soon.
Such a good dude.
Yeah, so cool. Dude. Yeah, it just comes
His
through.
Demeanor is like that too. Like when he gives notes and stuff, and it's interesting because like I wanted to get into it with him. Like I've never seen him get angry. You can't be that high up in a network and not get angry. So clearly he's had to have gotten angry before, but I've just never seen it. Like yeah, you know, so
yeah. Well,
listen, I gotta hop. I gotta go meet PJ, PJ. So I'll call you in a bit.
All right, bye. Oh bye, wait, buddy. What? Are we done?